We are in the home stretch almost. Today I will complete the discussion of EM and structural learning, and I'm actually going to try and start a small subtopic basically, which is relational probabilistic models. Okay, so I'll at least explain to you what the background is, and then, you know, I don't obviously cannot do too much justice to it, but you'll get a feel for how do you generalize Bayes networks to handle relational models. Okay, so presumably, depending on how things go, I guess I might actually complete that today itself, or I might complete part of it in on 29th. And then if the rest of 29th class would be general discussion about anything that has happened in the semester. And first and sixth, basically, we're going to decide the final project presentation schedule. Okay, so I'm just going to open the, I mean, I'll put a wiki thing, and then you just have to sign up. Okay, so that's the scenario. Any questions? Okay. So we were talking about EM last time, right? We figured out that basically, even when you have whether you have incomplete data, that means some of the tuples are missing the values of some of the attributes, or hidden attributes, that means the entire column is missing, which basically means you may have made it out of, you know, thin air, you know. In either case, you can actually do EM, expectation maximization algorithm, where in essence you just start by, you know, initializing the values for the incomplete data, and then based on that you compute the model. Basically, you compute the maximum likelihood. Using the maximum likelihood estimation, you compute the best generative model, and using the generative model, you re-predict the missing values, and then learn the model again until the likelihood no longer increases. Okay, and the interesting point, of course, is that as you do this E and M step, and in the EM, actually E is expectation. Expectation means inference. You are given the evidence you have, what do you expect is the value for this incomplete, this hidden variable or the missing variable. So expectation is the inference, okay? And the maximization is the learning part, because you're trying to find the parameters such that the likelihood is maximized. Now, the one of the interesting things we'll see is both the expectation, so you know, we talked about some reasons as to why actually EM works, and you can also think of EM as a stepless, you know, hill climbing algorithm. But the bigger issue is that essentially the maximum likelihood, so the likelihood of the data, because you have to marginalize over the hidden variables, you have a log of sums, and so it does not have any of the desirable characteristics of the likelihood function, which made it, for example, unentangled parameters, and you can compute a separate equation and a separate partial derivative for each of the parameters, and then get the value, get their values at the maximum likelihood. That was not possible. Okay, you essentially have to do some sort of a hill climbing, and EM is a particular type of hill climbing where, in essence, you're computing a lower bound, and you are finding the maximum point for that lower bound, and you're taking a step in the x-axis from here to here, and then so you in effect are in this place on the real function, and then you do the same thing again, you compute a lower bound here, and then you maximize that, and then move on until you reach the maximum. Now, of course, you could get stuck in local maximum. You cannot avoid it, because this possibly has a multiple maxima, and you could get stuck in local maximum. Okay, So the algorithm for EM itself is simple enough. What's interesting is why does it work? That's what we were discussing last time. But you know, once you can figure out that the magic seems to work, you know, doing the magic itself is simple. Okay. The only interesting thing, of course, is here is a scenario where during learning you have to do inference. Until now, I mean, in the complete parameter case, you never had to do inference as part of learning. Okay. Here the expectation step is an inference step. And you have to do that. And then do maximization and then do it iteratively until you reach closure, until you reach the maximum. Okay. So the parameter, you basically initialize the parameters ignoring the missing information. Repeat until convergence. You can essentially either ignoring or initialize the expected values for the missing information, either one, either which way. So in fact, you cannot completely ignore the missing information if an entire column is missing, right? Then you will not know anything about those values. So you have to initialize some values there. Okay. And then basically based on that, then you each step essentially says compute the expected values of the unobserved variables assuming the current parameter values. Okay. M step says, and then this involves essentially inference, and so if you have the EM being done on a Bayes net, then you're doing Bayes net inference. Okay. Now in general, So that's one part, and you know, forget about the green part for a minute. The M step, compute the new parameter values to maximize the probability of data. Okay. Although in some cases the lower bound is, I mean, in most cases, lower bound is analytically more tractable than the real log likelihood. Okay. In complex cases, even this might actually be hard. So for example, if it's a Bayes network, at least finding the top, finding the optimum of this lower bound would involve just taking the counts, ratios of the counts. If this were a Markov network, which we did not talk about here, so the lower bound is sort of being done with the complete data assumption because it's using the current labels of the data. Okay, and if you are using the Markov network, then essentially finding the lower bounds maximum itself involves a little hill climbing. Do you see what I'm saying? So that also, so there is work to be done here too, some cases. Okay, you have to keep that in mind. And secondly, doing the expectation could be costly, depending upon your network, whether it's Markov network or Bayes network, whether it's singly connected or multiply connected. Doing the inference on the network can be exponential to begin with. Okay, so the way EM is written directly, this step could be exponential. This step might itself involve, the M step might actually involve its own hill climbing process. And then the total EM together is hill climbing on the bigger log likelihood. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so one thing is since all you are interested in is really hill climbing on this, you might want to know, here is the interesting question. So is it really, really important that I be here to make the step? What if I do a few steps and I just improve my likelihood on the lower bound up to here? And then I'll get up to this and then start moving. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you were to do that, then instead of doing the maximization, which for Bayes networks, it's easy because maximization means essentially just taking counts. For Markov networks or for some continuous parameter cases, it in itself involves hill climbing. Okay, so you might say, "Oh, I'll just do a few improvements and stop," and that would be fine. That will just be a slightly different hill climbing. It's not the greediest hill climbing you could have done with this lower bound. Okay, and similarly, you could also do for the expectation, you don't need to do exact inference. All you need to do is a better estimate of the missing values given the current parameter. Okay, and so if you are, for example, you know, in the Bayes net inference, you know, instead of exact algorithms, you also have approximate algorithms, you know, sampling based algorithms. Okay, so you could run the sampling based algorithm for a few iterations and get what are the best probabilities for these values. Okay, so in, by doing this, you will reduce the per iteration cost of the EM, but you increase the total number of iterations required for the EM probably. Okay, and these variations all have different names. We'll actually, I think, let me skip and actually show that slide. Okay, so EM variants, one of the variants is called GEM, generalized EM, where you just increase the likelihood in the M step. You don't maximize it. You see what I'm saying? Okay, and there is an MCMC EM where you just approximate the E step. Okay, then the MAP EM actually is, okay, so those are different. The MAP and structural EM, these are essentially the hidden parameters themselves, hidden variables themselves might, can be handled either in a MLE scenario or a MAP or a Bayesian learning scenario. The entire EM can all be done. Again, so there is an orthogonal dimension. Remember, there's one orthogonal dimension of, do you want to, is your philosophy to maximize the likelihood to do the MAP or to do the Bayesian learning? Okay, and the other one is, do you have complete data or incomplete data? And the third one is, do you at least have the structure or you don't have the structure? Okay, so EM, there is a version of EM with respect to structure, obviously generalization of EM with respect to structure, and there's also EM which takes MAP estimates rather than MLE estimates in the maximization step. Okay, but these are interesting because these two is what I was talking about in this green one, because each of these steps, the cost can be reduced so that the per iteration cost is reduced, but the total number of iterations may increase. What does this remind anybody of? This kind of playing around with the individual steps, complexity. We have, this is not the first time we did iterative algorithms, right, in this course. So I'm only talking about this course. So there was another iterative algorithm at least that I could think of, where rather than do the right thing, we sometimes do the approximate thing in the iteration. Value. Not value iteration, you're close. Do the other one. Yes, yeah, good. You got a point. So, right. But at least you are in the general idea. Because in the policy iteration, remember, policy iteration, you had to evaluate the policy. Right? And to evaluate the policy right, you need to actually write a bunch of simultaneous equations and solve them. Instead, we decided rather than write a bunch of simultaneous equations and solving them, we will just run the value iteration for a few times so that you get a better feel for the value of the policy. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's useful to connect these things because, you know, I think the ideas are similar across. I mean, they have obviously, whether or not it's working in this particular situation, you need to have a separate formal analysis. But there are only so many different types of ideas around. Okay. So indeed, that's kind of policy iteration is what where we did this kind of a thing, actually. Okay. And so in some sense, both the steps can be approximated in the case of EM. Let me just show you two examples of EM in operation. I already told you that the k-means is an EM, is a EM variant. In k-means, essentially, what you're doing is you're doing hard assignment. You know, every point is assigned with point one, 1.0 probability to one of the clusters. Okay, this is a soft clustering scenario. Okay, this is what soft k-means. You can either call it soft k-means or the EM algorithm, okay? And so here, the setup here is you have a simple Bayes network where class is determining X. It's a very simple Bayes network, okay? The class variable is determining X, and X is a real number, and each class essentially determines X as a normal distribution, okay? As a normal distribution, and suppose we essentially are thinking of two-dimensional Gaussian. Okay, so then here you have, let's say, these are the three Gaussians that are actually generating the data. And so this is information that your algorithm doesn't have. Instead, you essentially, so you have three bivariate Gaussians, okay, from which you sampled each of them and got points, a whole bunch of points from them. Now clearly, this Gaussian tends to give points more in this region, this Gaussian tends to give points more in this region, this tends to give points in this region, but it's not hard and fast. You know, there may be leakage. Like for example, there could be a point here which can be generated by this Gaussian with just a low probability. Right? Okay, so now I have all these points. So all I saw is this. Now if I have a model saying, well, these could have been generated, I believe somebody told me that these were generated by three Gaussians. What I want to know is find the generative model. Okay, so in essence I can say these are x values, this x data x is x1, y1, x2, y2, etc. Those are its, you know, attributes, right? So the class attribute is determining the x value using a Gaussian. Your CPT, the conditional probability density, is a Gaussian. Except you don't know the parameters. And you don't know the parameters of the, I mean, and you never see C at all. What's interesting is if I tell you for each of them, this is from class 1, this is from class 2, etc., then this becomes just a simple complete data maximization case. Complete data, you know, parameter learning case. However, all you are given now is these, and you never, in none of these data points, is the value of class information available. That's what makes it hidden data case. Okay, so what you would then do is essentially you give, and so, you know, when you run EM on this data, then you basically say, you know, for each of them, you'll give a class, you know, initialize a class value. Then based on the class value, okay, based on that, you essentially do this iteration where you will see the likelihood that the data is generated by a particular Gaussian. Okay, and then, you know, I'll show you the details in a minute, but, you know, so when you do that EM iterations, then you will actually compute three Gaussians for this data which correspond to that, which pretty much kind of, in this case, just completely retrieved the Gaussian. Okay, so the steps are like this. So initialize the parameters randomly. That means, notice that you need the mu and sigma parameters for the Gaussians. And you need like the mu and sigma parameters for each of the Gaussians. Okay, so I'll assume, I'll just start by initializing the mu sigma parameters in, you know, randomly. I also need, by the way, a prior probability for the class itself. Because this is what, I mean, if I have this as my network, then I also need a prior probability for the class, right? So I'll assume that also I'll initialize. So I can say one third, one third, one third, for example, because there are three classes, okay? And then I will slowly change that parameter as well as the mu and sigma parameters. The important thing is the mu and sigma parameters are required to specify the dependency of X on C, and the weight parameters are required to provide the prior on the class itself. Again, just from the base network itself directly, just to specify that, okay? So what I do, I initialize the parameters randomly, and then in the E step, I compute the probabilities, given the parameters of the Gaussians, the probabilities that each of these data points are generated by a particular class. So for each data point, I compute the posterior on the class variable. Now, because the class is only three values, then in essence, for each data point, x1 and y1, I will compute it's the probability 0.2 that it is c1, 0.4 that it is c2, and 0.4 that it is c3, let's say. Okay, this is what my E step told me. Okay, and those then, rather than, you know, in the, I mean, actually, let's make it slightly different. Let's make this 0.3 and 0.4, 0.6, and maybe 0.45, and 0.35, let's say. Okay, so now, if this was k-means, then it would have just said C2 is the class for this particular data point. All EM would do is it says actually this point belongs 0.2 to C1, 0.45 to C2, 0.35 to C3. That's what it says. So it's a fractional membership data point. Okay. Now, first thing, one thing I want you to understand is how did you get these numbers, 0.2, 0.45, 0.35? That's because to compute the probability that a data point belongs to class I, given the data is xj, that's what you're computing, right? Now, using Bayes rule, you would say that is alpha times xj given c equal to I times c equal to I. Agreed? Okay. Now, the c equal to I is the prior on c. That's the weight vector. And xj given c equal to I is whatever the Gaussian distribution tells you. If, you know, with c equal to I, you know mu I and sigma I are the right, the mean and variance parameters. Okay, then the question is, if that is the case, what's the probability that xj would be generated by that Gaussian? You just look up. You plug in the value. Okay, so you normalize this because basically it has to belong, the probability that it belongs to class 1 plus class 2 plus class 3 has to be equal to 1. So you the alpha is the normalizing factor. Okay, so that's how I computed those numbers. But this, you know, I could have, in this case, it's a small enough thing that I actually showed you the use of Bayes rule. But the point of knowing Bayes networks is if you have a tool for Bayes networks underneath, then you just ask it directly. Okay, here is my Bayes network, here are the parameters, tell me if x equal to x1, y equal to y1, what is the posterior on C? I'll tell you. And the way it will tell you is doing this. Right? Okay. So don't get confused about the actual steps, especially for the next one in the textbook. They do the actual inference by hand. It's not so much that when you're doing EM, you will sit there and do inference by hand. You know, you just call the Bayes network inference algorithm. Okay. So this part is inference. Once I do this, essentially I have for each vector, I mean each of these points, I know their fractional membership in each of the classes. So the next step then is the M step. And the M step essentially, now I have complete data. Okay, so I have a complete data and I need to compute the Gaussian parameters in the case of complete data. And remember, we did this already, you know, several slides back. If I can very quickly go back there, somewhere like this, right? We did this, okay? And all we had to do essentially is, if you were to actually take the maximum likelihood and, you know, equate the partial derivatives to zero, then you would have known essentially that mu equal to the number of points divided by the total, number of points in this class divided by the total, okay? The sigma is the normal variance, right? Just by counts again, okay? So that's basically what you do. Okay, I'm coming here. Just give me a second. That's basically what you do here. So all you now do is essentially you are looking not just at xj, you know, you're not only looking at the mu I is computed in terms of the fractional membership of j in the ith class times the x value divided by ni. Now in this case, x is a vector, so you will get mu would be a vector too because you have a x1, y1, xi, yi. Okay? And the same way you compute the sigma, I'm sorry, okay, the variance. And the other parameter you need is wi. And that is basically says, again, the likelihood estimation says that the wi, the best wi for C would be the total number of entities. Okay, so the wi is the the fractional, add up all the fractional memberships of each of the points in C1. That's the Ni. So that divided by total number of points. That's the likelihood of each of the classes. So if you have 10 points and you essentially are saying like 2.75 of them belong to class 1. And the way you got 2.75 is because fractional membership is allowed. Okay? So you do that. This is one iteration now. Now I have new parameters. I can go back to E step and do this step again. And then I do M step, E step, M step, until my likelihood is no longer changing. Okay? The interesting thing is, if you were to, as the iterations progress, if you were to chart the likelihood, okay, and here is the likelihood of the data with respect to the true model. This is the likelihood of the data given the true model. Okay, because you know the true model. Remember, in this case, we started with the true model. And you will see that the likelihood actually sort of monotonically increases. And it sort of converges. Okay? So that's your EM in action. And this is a soft k-means idea too in this particular case. Okay? So you are not essentially saying winner takes all. You are allowing fractional membership. Okay? The other one is the candy example. That too is a Bayes network, except it's a slightly more complex Bayes network example. So in this case, you have a bag which is never seen, and the flavor wrapper and hole which are seen in each data point. That means for each candy, once you open it, you know which flavor it has, which wrapper it has, and whether or not it has a hole. Okay, but the point is, your belief essentially is that bag determines flavor, wrapper, and hole. And so you need like the parameters for flavor given bag, parameters for wrapper given bag, parameters for hole given bag, as well as prior parameters for bag itself. And there's apparently, I guess, two kinds of bags in this case. Okay? Once again, when you initialize the parameters, you are essentially initializing the Bayes network probabilities. That's all you mean. Okay, you're trying to learn the real probabilities, but you start by initializing it with some numbers. Okay, so in this particular case, this is again a worked out example in the textbook. I'm assuming you read this, but I'm just going through it again. And maybe if you didn't understand it first time, you can read it again. Suppose I actually know the real parameters. This was the real parameters, let's say. That means that this is 0.5, 0.5, and then these are all 0.8s, and these are all 0.3s. Suppose that was the true parameter. That's not known to the learner. What I would then do is, suppose I use these true parameters and I generated 1,000 samples, 1,000 random samples, okay, from this Bayes network. And then I essentially removed the bag piece of each of the data point and gave the rest to the learner. Okay? Then you would have to start by initializing the parameters and then doing the EM. Okay? In the beginning, you have none, so let's assume you just randomly initialize it that way. Why randomly that way? That's what I decided. Okay? But you could have done something else. Okay? And then based on that, then you can essentially compute the second iteration by saying, given these parameters, for each of the wrapper candy that has been unwrapped, what is the probability of it being in bag 1 versus bag 2. That's that. And in the textbook, basically he says that, well, this is what a normal Bayes network will tell you. If you have an inference algorithm for Bayes network, you know, implemented, then given this information, you can actually just compute the bag. Right? Now, once I do that, that's your E step. And then in the M step, I essentially take the counts, because this is a normal CPT-based Bayes network. So in the M step, I have complete data now. So I just take the counts to get the various parameters. Okay? And he basically points out that in one iteration, the log likelihood goes from minus 2044 to minus 2021. Okay, so obviously log likelihood improved. And what's more interesting is, if log likelihood improved by, in this case, what, 23? That means likelihood improved by something like 10 power 23. It's a log likelihood that improved here. Okay, so these are like, you know, it's one of the other interesting things is that actually taking logs makes these things, you know, handleable, because the likelihoods themselves are extremely, you know, the likelihood of a particular data given a network is always very, very unlikely. Okay, so when you do speech recognition, for example, and somebody says this is the, you know, word you spoke versus this, if you ask them exactly what are the probabilities associated with them, they're always depressingly low. It's just that between two losing probabilities, one is slightly better than the other. Because when I speak, there are so many words I could have spoken, right? And the probability mass is slowly kind of spread over the whole of it, and then one of them is slightly better than the other, and that wins. Okay? That's about EM. Any questions? Okay, so just remember that EM is a separate, so you had the philosophy, which is MLE, MAP, Bayes learning. That's one direction. Data, complete, incomplete. That's another direction. And then third is some sort of connected to this, topology, known, unknown. Those are the dimensions. Okay, of course, there's also a fourth dimension, which I can't even draw, which is how are you representing the underlying distribution? Are you using Markov networks or Bayes networks? Right, okay. And we only stuck to Bayes networks in this until now. So the last thing I want to talk to you before we move on from this Bayes learning, you know, statistical learning part, is structured learning. That's basically this. Okay, to some extent, that's the hardest problem, but there is not too much that can be said. Essentially, what you would wind up doing, the basic idea is, if you are not given the topologies, you guess a topology and see, you know, and find the best parameters with respect to that topology. Guess another topology, find the, you know, best parameters with respect to the other topology, and now you are stuck with which one do I like better. Okay, so there are two real ideas. Idea one is, if I give you a topology, okay, one of the interesting things to remember is when I give you a Bayes network topology, it essentially states my belief about conditional independencies that hold in that domain. Okay, so suppose I have a three node data. Suppose I have three nodes data. Okay. Now, suppose I said this is my topology. Then it must be the case that P of y given z and x is the same as P of y given x. That's a conditional independence. If that doesn't hold, this is not the topology. Right? I mean, in fact, any of them doesn't hold, it's a ding to the topology. But this is not the only thing. In fact, there's another one which says PZ given Y and X is the same as PZ given X. Those are the two conditional independencies. Okay? So what you could do is, you have the data, remember the training data that's given to you. You can use the training data to see whether, first of all, these conditional independencies hold. Okay, how do you check whether conditional independencies hold? You essentially can compute, given the data, you can compute this and this and see if they're equal. right? And if they are not, then you know that, you know, hypothesis is broken. Of course, the problem is these conditional dependencies are asymptotic statements for large data case. For the small amount of training data you have, an independence that is supposed to hold might look like it doesn't hold, and an independence that doesn't hold might look like it holds. Right? So there is always this worry about whether or not the decisions you made are significant enough. But that's one way. So in fact, people do use this to kind of come up with the initial topology. Okay. Now, of course, there is also an idea zero, which is I have a rich uncle who sort of told me that some of these dependencies hold in this domain. So at least no partial topology of the domain. Okay, if I don't know anything, then if when I guess the topology, then I can check whether the independencies hold. That's what this one is. Okay? And the other idea is check whether the topology you came up with agrees with the data. It's a, both of them you're kind of doing it with respect to. So in fact, one interesting question is that this perhaps you can ask a human expert. You know, do you really think this independence holds in this domain? Okay, but if you're actually computing it using just the data, then you know the second one is also using the data. Second idea also uses the data and sees what's the likelihood of the data given this topology. Okay, and so to some extent, if you're using the data for answering this question, then the first and second are sort of using the same source to make their decisions. But the first one, you can also use the experts if they're available. Okay, but then you can ask, why aren't the experts giving me the entire topology? Why are they just, you know, asking me to ask them some questions? But, you know, it depends on how bad your life is. Okay. The second is that consider which topology agrees with the data more. That means which provides the higher likelihood. So I have this topology and I have this other topology. Okay, I can compare these two and with respect to my data, and I basically for each of them I found the best parameters. Now, given the parameters, I can then compute the likelihood of my data. It's like there's a circularity involved, right? I mean, in essence, it's sort of if you think in terms of if you're thinking in terms of like curve fitting kind of scenarios, then it's essentially like making up your mind about topology is like making up your mind about, do you think there is a line here? Or there is a sine wave here, or there is a parabola here. Okay, having said there is a line, you still need to find what's the best line. That's the MLE. Do you see what I'm saying? So the best line may be this. Okay, and having said there is a, your other topology is I have a seventh order polynomial that is hidden there. So having said this is a seventh order polynomial, I can use the same data to find the best seventh order polynomial. Now having done this in both cases, I can then compute, essentially in this case, I can compute the mean square error with respect to the line and mean square error with respect to the seventh order polynomial. Right? And then see which one fits better. That looks good in practice, you know, upfront, like that's what you would do here, okay? So the distances there are like the likelihoods here. And you picked up, topology which has a higher likelihood. The problem is overfitting is always possible. In that case, if you are comparing, you know, seventh order with eighth order polynomial always win. Because you can always find an eighth order polynomial that fits the data even closely than seventh order polynomial. But the problem in doing so is it will always actually fit to even the noise in the data. Okay, and the same situation here, if I'm comparing this, not to this, but rather to this, then you will see that the likelihood of the data cannot reduce with an extra edge compared to, so this guy's likelihood cannot be less than this guy's likelihood. Yeah? No, there is no bidirectional edges. Right now it's still acyclic. Base networks are acyclic. Markov networks don't have directions at all. Okay? So, then basically this will always be more likely than this. But then that basically means you will keep overfitting. Okay? So eventually, if you want to do this likelihood-based idea, then you need to penalize the complexity of the network somehow. Now, a strict Bayesian would say, you know, this is the price you are paying for not doing the right thing. You are supposed to be doing Bayesian learning where there is a prior over all the topologies. This is a very interesting thing. I mean, if you want to do Bayesian learning when the topology is not known, if you want to do Bayesian learning when the parameters are not known, remember, we had to have a prior over the parameters. If you want to do Bayesian learning when the structure is not known, you need a prior over structure. You should say certain prior, given a structure, you should say what's the prior probability of that structure actually being the structure for this data. And then a Bayesian will just basically change so the strict Bayesian learning for structure learning is now has a posterior now on the structures and posterior on the parameters for each of the structures. And it's, you know, never makes up its mind, right? Obviously, if it was intractable for parameter learning, it's even more intractable for the structure learning. But it has a good idea, which is you need to at least take the prior probability into account. So if you don't want to do all the way to Bayesian, and you know that you're sunk with MLE, there is a middle ground, which was MAP, right? And MAP inference essentially would say, basically just maximize not the log likelihood. So you still pick a winner in the MAP, but don't maximize the likelihood. Maximize the likelihood plus prior. Okay? So all I now need to do is come up with some reasonable penalty metric, which will act as a probability. Okay, the more complex networks are less likely. Less complex networks are more likely. Okay, so here is an idea that people normally use. This is also connected to this notion of minimal description length principle. So essentially, to do MAP, you are now, and when you don't really have a user given input on which structures are more likely, which structures are less likely, you just make a generic prior, saying more complex ones are less likely. Do you understand what I'm saying? However, if I actually happen to know the problem, then it may be that, in fact, this data, I'm pretty sure, is generated by a polynomial between degrees 7th to 20th, in which case I should have a better prior which gives higher values to 7th up to 20th and lower after 20th and lower below 7th too. Okay? But if I don't know anything, I'll just assume more complex, bad. That's the minimum description length principle. That's the Occam's razor. That's basically you're just using them as a prior. Okay? And what you're doing in this case is, so you need to find some metric, okay, which kind of provides a, which kind of dings the structure for its complexity. Except you want to make sure that however complex the structure is, if as the data increases, if the amount of data you are looking at increases, then the data starts speaking more than the complexity, the penalty parameter. Okay, so what you wind up doing is notice that likelihood is already proportional to the amount of data you see, right? Do you see that? Remember, log likelihood is likelihood of first data point plus likelihood of second data point plus likelihood of third data point plus likelihood of fourth data point. Okay, so likelihood is already proportional to the size of the data. So the first thing that you might think is likelihood plus some penalty parameter, as just sort of subtract some number. So the number that I might want to subtract is, let's say, dimension of the graph. What would be the dimension of the graph? Dim G is the number of free parameters in the model, the number of parameters I need to learn. Now, upfront, you might think That, oh, I know exactly what that means. That is, the more the edges, the more the number of parameters. Yeah, that's sort of true, but keeping the edges constant, I can make the parameters more or less by using structured versus tabular CPTs. How many of you remember noisy R distribution from Bayes networks? If you use a noisy R distribution, then in essence you are getting by, if a node which has n parents, right, normally requires 2 power n tabular parameters. A noisy R distribution says, I'll just give you n parameters, not 2 power n parameters, but there is a big structural assumption that the way these n guys affect this is, this guy will be true only if, will be false only if all of them are failing. If any of them succeed, if any of them are true, this guy would be true. So noisy R parameter, basically, given the same structure, you know, you and your friend have both the same structure, you are learning a noisy R CPD, he's learning a CPT, which is an actual tabular representation. His dimensionality would be much higher. Yours would be much lower. So you get a lower penalty, he gets a higher penalty, given the same topology. And so the dime G takes both into account. It's just the number of free parameters that you need to learn. The denser the connections, the higher dime G, and the more structured the CPTs, the lower the dime G. So again, when I'm talking about essentially the, you're not just thinking in terms of topologies, you're also thinking in terms of how are the CPDs represented. Okay, so that takes this into account, and the only thing that I'm going to do here is, I'm basically, you know, if this is just for the network, and as the data increases, you need to give it some sort of, if for each data point, you know, this guy increases. If you just don't do anything here, then there is no multiplier here. So you need to do some multiplier that sort of makes it proportional to m, so I just say log of m by 2, where m is the number of data points. And by doing this, in essence, as the data increases, this guy is increasing in terms of m, and this is increasing only in terms of log m. So as the data increases, the penalty factor weight, relative weight, becomes smaller. So even if you are comparing a more complex topology to a less complex topology, you know, if this more complex topology is, you know, and both of them seem to, this one seems to agree better than this on one data point, that's different from this seems to agree with the data more than this one on a million data points. Because that means, you know, data is actually crying out saying, I am really a 18th order polynomial, and you're still saying 18th order is bad. That makes no sense. Okay? So that's why you essentially do a score which is size of the data. It's a logarithm of the size of the data. And if you do it this way, then this is called the BIC or MDL score for structured learning. Okay, you still have this question of, you know, you have a way of, you know, computing the goodness of a node in your search space. You're doing hill climbing on the space of topologies. And you will be at a particular topology, you look at your neighborhood, you compute their MLEs, and then you compute their score value, the total score value. You see if any of them have better score than you. If so, you pick the neighbor which has the best score than you, and you say, that's me now. And then you do again. Now notice that in one iteration that you just did there, you already did not only learning for yourself, you also did learning for all your neighbors. And then you picked one guy. Do you see what I'm saying? And then you can have great fun if, in fact, you're doing hidden data, unknown topology. That means you have hidden variables and unknown topology. So then you still have to compare yourself to your neighbors, but then in saying learn for myself, so this part is the maximum likelihood with respect to the data. And that's the learning part for each topology. And this part is just the penalty for each topology. So this, you have to do it for yourself as well as each of your neighbors to do the hill climbing step. Okay, and so if you're doing with hidden data, you will be doing EM for yourself and all your neighbors, and then subtract this, you know, complexity parameter and see which, whether first of all any of your neighbor is better than you according to the score, and if so, pick the neighbor with the higher score. So you can imagine structured learning can be fun, okay, because it can take a long time. Okay, question. Any questions? Yes. There are variations of structured learning that are more Bayesian than just score based. Okay, so you may well be right that's one of those variants do that. I'm not completely aware of the details. Okay, there are people. In fact, the game in this. In fact, remember the guy who I showed in the beginning of the statistical learning, the Joshua Tannenbaum, who was talking about human mind uses priors, and you know there's cognitive plausibility for that. So he has done some work some years back, and there's been follow-up work on that later on too, where he essentially explicitly puts a prior on the structure and does Bayes learning. Okay, and to do that, as I said, essentially the tricky part, I mean, if you remind me, I can send you that paper. And the tricky part would be, remember in Bayesian learning, there is no learning. All that is there is inference. Now you have inference with, you know, in the Bayes learning with the conjugate priors, etc., that we looked at, there you only had to put a prior on the parameter. The topology is constant, held constant. And that itself made your life miserable because to some extent the parameters were continuous. Okay, and then each data point enters the Bayes network. So Bayes network keeps becoming bigger. So it's sort of a plate model. Okay, so each data point becomes part of the Bayes network. And then you're doing an inference to compute the posterior on these parameters. And the inference techniques for those, even if you have done Bayes networks before in 471 with me, which is probably the only class that may have spent too much time on Bayes networks, you still won't know how to deal with inference in the context of continuous parameters. There are tons of methods like variational methods, etc., which you have to use to actually compute do the inference. And that becomes the trick. So putting a structure, you know, is what Bayesians, putting a prior on everything is what Bayesians do. Okay, but then technical issues on that is once you put a prior, then you actually need to do inference with respect to that prior and compute the posterior on that. And that can become hard. So that's why you go for MAP sometimes. Okay? But MLE is out. That's the interesting thing. By the time you come to structured learning, MLE is not a contender. Because there is no way it can avoid overfitting. Okay? That's why that, you know, homework problem 3 is important for you to convince yourself that, you know, essentially likelihood just keeps increasing as you increase the density of the edges. And that's sort of equivalent to saying, if I say, find me the best seventh order polynomial that fits the data and compare it to the best second order polynomial that fits the data and see their likelihood and see the cumulative distance, you know, the cumulative errors both of these hypotheses make on the data, not on the test data, not on like a held out data, but just on the data. Clearly, seventh order cannot do worse than the second order one, because seventh order one allows second order as a subset. And so if you know how to do optimization, and if you really, really did pick the best seventh order polynomial, it can't be worse than the second order polynomial in terms of the distance, in terms of the, you know, cumulative distance. They can be worse. One can be worse on the other on held out test data, which, by the way, you can also do in Bayes networks, by the way. So for example, you have the amount of training data, you can keep piece of it away separately, and you don't use it at all during learning. okay? And then you basically can compare this and this on the held out data. That's possible, okay? But normally you want to use all the data you have to do the learning. Don't want to keep anything away. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so, you know, this is summary, but I don't know that I need to go into it. Summary of what we did, you know, Bayesian learning, the three dimensions and normal way of doing MLE, the way to do, where to handle the case when there is hidden data, which is EM, and the way to handle the case when you don't know the topology, which is structural learning. And each of these wind up taking the lower ones as subroutines, right? EM takes MLE and inference as a subroutine. And structured learning takes EM as a subroutine if you have hidden parameters. Or at least we'll take, you know, MLE as a subroutine. Okay? So the last thing that I want to start talking about today, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more next class, is relational probabilistic models. All the probabilistic models that we have done till now are essentially propositional. Okay? So remember, we in the beginning of the semester we talked about atomic, propositional, relational, and we did atomic stuff, which is basically these MDP models, atomic MDP models. We did relational stuff, I mean propositional and relational stuff in planning. In the case of Bayesian learning, basically Bayes networks are propositional because you're just thinking in terms of attributes and their values. Okay, so the question is, and obviously logic. We have predicate logic, we have first order logic, and we know why they are more useful than propositional logic. Okay, to the extent propositional probabilistic logic is kind of useful compared to, is more useful than propositional, purely propositional logic, then relational probabilistic logic could be more useful because it allows you to represent more things. And the question is, how would you go about generalizing what you know about probabilistic propositional models to make them work in relational and first order cases? Okay, mostly I'll talk about the relational. There is some text, discussion in the textbook on the first order case also. Okay, the textbook discussion is somewhat, you know, harder to follow, so I'm actually using slides from Lise Gator's tutorial on statistical relational learning from ECML 2007. So I'm just using just a few pieces to give you an idea to what are involved. I will send you a paper that kind of is accompanying this tutorial. You can read that, you know, at your leisure. Okay. So basic idea is, you know, there's like many different competing approaches for relational probabilistic models. First of all, just for propositional probabilistic models, we know there are at least two, you know, right? Bayes networks and Markov networks. There are many others, but you know at least those. Okay, there are things like chain graphs, etc., which you don't normally hear about outside of UAI community, but they are there too. Okay, so once you go from these to relational, then there's even more, you know, competing approaches. There's an entire book called SRL, Statistical Relational Learning, which talks about 14 different chapters of different approaches for dealing with relational case with propositional probabilistic models. So I will pick. The relational Bayes networks, mostly because you only know Bayes networks. Okay, there is actually a relational Markov networks, which is Markov logic networks that Pedro Domingos has been pushing. And since it's the beginnings of this direction, there are individuals who push different directions. Okay, so the one that I'm talking about is basically Getur and Daphne Koller. They have been interested in pushing this. The version which does generalization of Markov networks to relational case is Markov logic networks, and Pedro Domingos is interested in pushing that. And then the textbook actually, Stuart Russell is interested in first order probabilistic networks, and he has this thing called blog models. And he tells you something about it in one of the sections in the Bayes networks chapter, okay? Okay, so the relational Bayes networks can actually be understood quite well starting from relational databases. which, by the way, you guys realize that relational databases are have predicate logic semantics. Okay, so in essence, in relational databases, you have tables and you have relations between the tables. Okay, so you have an author table, you have a paper table, you have a review table, and the paper, and then there are primary key, foreign key dependencies between them. Okay, so for example, this paper has a review, you know, which is sort of in the review table, and this paper has a quality which is sort of which actually this paper actually has an author, which, you know, is written by somebody, you know, and then the quality and the paper itself has a quality, and whether or not it was accepted, the review itself has two very important things: the mood of the reviewer and the length of the paper. Okay, and the author, you have some important characteristics, the attributes, which is good writer, and, you know, assume they're all true false for now, and smart, right? And this is a realistic thing, you know, I mean, it's like, if you don't write well, your paper probably won't get in. If you're dumb, then your probably also paper will not get in. But if you have to pick between being dumb versus being a good writer, it becomes more interesting, right? Anyway, so you have, anyway, in a relational database model, you just have three tables with connections between them, right? Now, if I want to talk about relational based networks, so essentially it tells you the objects. The objects are author object, paper object, review object, and the attributes are the properties of the object. So you say author dot good writer, author dot smart, paper dot quality, paper dot accepted, review dot mode, review dot length. Okay, this is your normal relational databases. Okay, so if I want to capture this in a Bayes network, you know, it's as a generative model in Bayes network, then I can have something like this. This is just one example. Okay, so here now I'm saying author has two attributes, right? So the author object has its own Bayes network. It has one attribute smart, another attribute good writer. And review has mood and length. Paper has quality and accepted. Each of these are Bayes networks. And the interesting thing, of course, is first of all, mood influences length. Okay, I don't quite know whether length is the length of the review or the length of the paper. No, so the CPT will change. It does influence both, right? But if you know, if the influence is negative versus positive, depending upon the length of the paper versus, maybe it's the length of the review. Anyway, actually, it's probably the length of the review. Okay. Anyway, so the mood influences the length, and smartness and the good writing are disconnected. This is like a, we are doing a pet psychological theories of human beings. Okay, so by putting this as my network, I'm saying smartness doesn't, and by the way, I have enough students and I know this is true. Okay, I mean that writing well and being smart are orthogonal dimensions. They are orthogonal, okay. So smartness and good writers are disconnected, they're independent. However, they're connected with respect to the quality of the paper. The quality of the paper is essentially a function of both smartness and writing well. Again, you will agree, right? You know. And then the quality of the paper influences whether or not the paper is accepted, but it's also influenced by the mood of the reviewer. Okay, so first we told you very important information about graduate life, right? So how to write papers and all that, you know, very useful thing to learn. Secondly, you actually have an interesting Bayes network configuration here. And notice there are intrinsic links and there are extrinsic links. Like, for example, smartness of the author and the good writing ability of the author affects the quality of the paper. So there are probabilistic influences that transcend the tables in the database point of view. And they also transcend the object. So object encapsulates some of the dependencies in itself, but then there are some APIs through which it influences some of the other objects' attributes. This is what you know, right? So you can write this as a network, right? Now the question, of course, is what exactly is this network telling me? The interesting thing is that I can have 15 authors, then that means I have 15 copies of this. I have 78 papers. If you have 15 authors, you'll have 78 papers. And there are 78 copies of this. and 78 times 3 reviewers. So there's even more copies of this. So the underlying base network is humongous. But you can draw it yourself because I gave you a template. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because if I tell you I have one more author who wrote one more paper, you'll put one more author and one more paper, and that author only influences his paper's quality. He doesn't influence your quality, thank goodness. Right? So in some sense, you provided, so if you think in terms of, let's say, so suppose you just did not even have this and you have 1, 2, 3, 4 nodes at the relational level. When I added one more paper, the 4 nodes become 8 nodes total in the final network. In an 8 node situation, lots and lots of edges can be put in. But you're only going to put in the edges that are allowed by this relational skeleton. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what predicate logic does to you. You know, in essence, by saying there are relations in the world and that objects fall into equivalence classes, do you make your life simple or more complex? What do you guys think?
Simpler.
So, if that is the case, what becomes easy? When you say your life became simple, what became easy? For sure. Learning. If I believe, for example, that what this is saying is, irrespective of it's Rav writing Rav's paper, or Tom writing Tom's paper, or Chitta writing Chitta's paper, remember, for this you need like a CPT here. And the CPT tells you the author's smartness and good writerness, how does it affect quality? By sticking to this relational model, you are saying the name doesn't matter. Chitta and Rav have the same CPT with which they influence the quality of their own paper based on their smartness and their good writerness. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, what that then means is you have much fewer parameters. As the number of authors increase, you have more and more training data for the same CPT as to how quality and smartness and writing affects quality and acceptance. So the number of parameters you need to learn are remaining constant, and the number of objects increase, which means you have even more data. If on the other hand you try to make each of these networks different with their own CPTs, then you will need hugely more number of parameters. By assuming that the world has relational structure, you made your life simple by just saying there are only so few parameters. Now if you're wrong, of course you could be wrong. Maybe it turns out that, you know, Chitta's smartness and good writer ability affects his quality of paper in a different way, slightly different way than my smartness and my good writerness. In which case, my assumption that Chitta and I should be called one class called author is wrong. Maybe then eventually I would learn there are logic authors, there are planning authors. So you will split your equivalence class into two different subclasses. There's the logic authors for whom the smartness and good writing affects the quality in a different way than the planning authors for whom it affects in a different way. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so you'll slowly, and if you really, really, really are living in a world where there is no equivalence classes, then you would need to learn a lot more, but then you would be dead by now because you wouldn't have been here. If the world you are living in has no structure whatsoever, then your ancestors would have died and so you won't be here. Okay, so in some sense, the reason as to why we should go for relations, it's a huge leap of faith that there is structure in the world. There is, you know, there are relations, there are objects of equivalence class, etc. Okay, but that leap of faith has been more or less seems to work. And it definitely improves your learning, time. Okay, so one thing, even today's discussion, even short discussion that we are having today should make you realize is the more interesting thing about relational-based networks is the representation. The learning doesn't become harder, it becomes easier. Because for the same data, For the same data, you have much fewer parameters to learn because you assumed all authors have the same relation between their papers and their smartness. Whereas a normal Bayesian network will allow each author to have a very different relation with their papers. And you're saying you're living in a better world where there is regularity. Okay, so that's your relational model. And now, for example, for this accepted, I need to provide, since this is a Bayes network, I have to provide the probability that paper dot accepted is true, given paper dot quality and paper dot review dot mood. That's what I'm asking you to give. Okay, so I may give you this. This may be the number. So either I would have given you as part of giving the relational Bayes network, I need to give you the skeleton, which is the topology, which is like equivalent of topology in the normal case, except now the topology is our templates of equivalence classes. And it sort of grows. Okay, here's a sanity check. So if I get more authors, you know, the underlying Bayes network is increasing in size. Have you in this class seen a situation where the underlying Bayes network keeps increasing in size? Where? When? What? In Bayes learning. Okay? Right? And that's exactly true. Okay? So in some sense, in Bayes learning, in fact, there is a very interesting connection between what you're doing here, which is sort of thinking in terms of predicate logic, etc., and what you wound up doing in Bayes learning, basically because these structured models, one type of structured model is a plate model. And when you have a Bayes network, you have the parameters affecting the plate corresponding to the data. And as more data points come, you keep copying the plate. You did the same thing there. In fact, once the parameter is decided, how it affects the data point, that CPT is constant. As new data points come, they just have more places in the network, but they use the same exact CPTs from the theta. Do you see what I'm saying? So in some sense, you saw a relational version of the Bayes network. Plate models are essentially relational versions too. Okay, but you know, anyway, you're looking at this here. So I gave you the skeleton, which is the objects, their attributes, the interconnections. Who is dependent on who, and then I also have to give the CPTs. The CPT in this particular case is, you know, this one. Now to specify it, I have to give this. To learn it, you have to learn it. Now, as I said, as the number of authors, papers, reviews increase, this corresponds to a much bigger Bayes network. But it has a very few free parameters. So the complexity measure for a RBN is lower if you look at the structure learning. So given the same data, if you learn a relational Bayes network, you have a lower complexity than if you learn a non-relational Bayes network, because then you are assuming everybody is created completely different. Everybody is unique. Okay? So once you have a relational skeleton, now if you have two authors, this is what I've been saying. If I have two authors, this guy wrote two papers, this guy wrote one paper, this guy has two reviewers, this guy has one review, and so you basically, you know, throw in all of them, but you know how to write the full Bayes network. Writing a full Bayes network starting from the relational skeleton is like starting from a predicate logic database and propositionalizing it. Right? If I know the finite domains, if you don't have functions, which is what would make things first order and you scream, if you only have finite domains for the variables, right, then essentially given a predicate logic database, you can write an exponentially larger but not infinite propositional database. Okay? And the same thing here. So I have a relational network, I can write an underlying Bayes network. The thing is, there's a humongous similarity in the CPTs being used. The CPT here is the same as the CPT here is the same as the CPT here. And that reduces the number of parameters you need to learn. Okay? Let me So PRMs versus base nets, the semantics of PRMs are really in terms of the underlying base nets. Just as you can give semantics for predicate logic in terms of the underlying propositional database. Okay, that doesn't work very well in first order case, because that's where you needed like Herbrand semantic, Herbrand universe and all that fun stuff. Okay, otherwise you can get semantics of the predicate logic completely in terms of the assembly language, which is your propositional logic. Okay, so for here the base network would be the assembly language for the relational base networks. Okay, however, the PRM defines the dependencies at the class level rather than at the object level. That means these dependencies and their CPTs are used for all objects of that class. And then the PRM also allows dependencies between the attributes of different objects. That means the reviewer's mood affects the paper's decision. That's allowed. Okay. One interesting, I already sort of told you the learning is easy. I'll do some more discussion of this when I come back next class, but I want you to understand what's interesting about relational based networks and how it's kind of connected to something that I told you about lifted planning many years, many, many classes back. Okay. So you have a skeleton like this and you want to do inference, let's say. What can you do? You can convert the skeleton given the number of objects, you can compile it down into a big base network. Then I say I have a base network, I know how to do inference. So I have reduced it to a problem I know. The same thing is true for relational reasoning versus relational logic reasoning versus propositional logic reasoning. You can always say you can do relational logic reasoning by just converting it to an equivalent propositional database and do inference there. Okay? But oftentimes that could be very, very inefficient. Because, you know, think about it this way, right? Suppose I have a big database of 10,000 let's just say 100 predicate logic sentences, and you know, with finite quantification, you know, for all X, rich X means happy X, and then I have a rich Tom, and I want to see whether happy Tom is true. Okay, if the way you're going to do this is directly converting this whole thing into first into a predicate logic, I mean propositional logic database, and then do inference, then you wasted a humongous amount of time, because your compilation, you know, basically looked at everything that's unconnected to the inference at hand. Whereas you could actually directly do lifted inference. You can actually see that for all X, rich X implies happy X, rich Tom, you know, X and Tom can be unified. Unification is lifting, by the way. Okay? And so rich Tom, happy Tom can be derived. That is sticking to the relational level, predicate level, and doing more efficient inference. That's what is called lifting. And in between lifting and full compilation is a different idea, which is you say, okay, you are interested only in richness of Tom, and you have 100 sentences, but I think only these two sentences have anything to do with the richness of Tom. So I will only convert them into propositional logic, then do propositional logic inference on that. That would be an in-between idea. Okay? So the in-between idea is, rather than generate the entire base network, assembly language, which is base network for us is propositional logic for logic, you would only generate a piece of the base network that's actually, and you have to prove to yourself that the stuff that you did not generate won't affect the probabilities that you're trying to compute. If it's hard in logic, it's somewhat harder in probability, because more things affect each other. At least in logic, in the entailment case, you don't have abjective entailment. Evidence does not change the status of the cause. But in probabilistic case, evidence changes the likelihood of the cause. So it's less like, so you will have even, you know, you have fewer opportunities to say this is not relevant, this is not relevant. But there are still some opportunities. And the more effective algorithms for doing inference in relational models essentially either do lifted inference or reduce the compilation to only the part of the overall network that is really relevant for answering that query. And once they do that, so instead of getting this big a thing, suppose I just use this much, then I just use my normal base network inference. Okay, now it sort of looks like cheating, right? Because I said, wow, there is something called predicate logic. But then the first thing you do is convert it into propositional logic. It's more or less what I'm saying. So if you don't really do lifted inference, you would not have believed predicate logic is a topic on its own. And the reason you still need to believe it's a topic on its own is because predicate logic is making assumptions about regularity in the world. How you reason with it is different from what assumptions you make about the regularity of the world. Okay? So in RBNs, in relational networks, there is a lot of work that's going on in how to do inference more efficiently at the lifted level or by just looking at the piece of the base network that matters. And learning, which is the last slide, and actually I can be done today. I might come back next week and we'll do just general discussion. Learning is easy because, as I said, you know, if you'll again have, you know, complete data case, hidden data case, structured learning case. But if you just want to understand the complete data case, you know, essentially you have lots of data, but all of them, there's a big base network, but all of them have the same parameter. You know, large pieces of the base network is copying the same parameter. So in essence, the same amount of data goes a longer way for a relational based network because it is learning fewer parameters. And you do the learning itself the same exact way, the counts. Okay? So there's nothing to teach about learning in relational based networks. It's actually easier, at least for the complete data case. Inference is a different matter. Inference, if you don't mind just converting it into the underlying base network, you don't need to teach that either. If not, you can talk about how do you look for the relevant parts of the base network on which to do the reasoning. Okay, and there's a lot of work on how to do that, more effectively. That's been going on. But irrespective of whether you do inference this way or in a more efficient way, learning-wise, for at least the complete data case. Because for complete data case in Bayes networks, you never have to do inference as part of learning. If you use MLA, this is stuff that should become second nature to you after the SLM, statistical learning lectures. Okay, if you're doing complete data and you're using MLE, then as part of learning, you don't need to do inference. If you have incomplete data, then you need to do inference. If you're doing Bayes learning, then you need to do inference because there's no learning. In fact, you just compute the posterior. So you can do learning on these networks without knowing how to do inference on them. And it could very well be that predicate logic is just syntactic sugar. In fact, logicians believe that predicate logic is syntactic sugar. It's only at the first order level that logic's expressiveness changes. That brings up the question of how do I generalize this into first order? Read the chapter, there's a small section in Bayes, Russell stuff, but that's basically unknown objects, etc. Okay, so we'll do a little more probably on this when I come back next class. But I'll send you the paper that I was basing my discussion on, and come to next class prepared to do general discussion on anything that we have covered in this entire semester. Okay, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.